This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Last night, the legislative session concluded, the 2021 regular session. We'll talk about that and more with our two guests for most of the hour today. Melissa Flournoy on the left, the former state lawmaker from Shreveport who lives in Baton Rouge, and Jeff Satto, who is in Shreveport as a professor of note for a few decades at LSU Shreveport. He is a noted political scientist from the right side of the political spectrum. And the good thing about these two guests is they can roll with the flow and talk about just about anything comfortably. And we'll start with just a brief mention. Today is, of course, June 11, 2021. It's the 65th birthday of former New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. Yesterday was the 50th birthday of former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. And Jeff Satto, obviously, one was from the right, one was from the left, but in some context, Nagin and Jindal share the mantra that they did not achieve what they wanted to achieve. Your thoughts about the legacies of each of those men?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, in the case of Jindal, he was in some ways ahead of his time, and part of his own fault, he kind of got distracted there during his second term, but he did have some notable achievements, did start finally to get the state going in the right direction, but clearly more could have been done. Case of Nagin, you know, I guess he failed because he got caught. He tried to enrich himself and got caught, so yeah, I guess he didn't set out to achieve what he wanted to achieve there either.
Well, the conventional wisdom now, and it's also shared by many on your side of the political aisle, is that Jindal was an abject failure. You don't think so?
No, and there was certainly many untapped potential things that could have been done, but did some very good things. I mean, off the top of my head, there was some minor halt in the ever-increasing size of Louisiana government. There was the state essentially getting out of the public hospital business. And, you know, there are others, but we could maybe discuss that another time.
All right. Well, Melissa Flournoy, my guess is that you're no fan of Bobby Jindal and probably not a big cheerleader for Ray Nagin.
Well, you know, Jim, I always say there are two kinds of politicians. You know, those that want to be somebody and those that want to do something. And I'm afraid both of those guys were be somebodies, and neither one have, in my opinion, a great legacy of service or of making the state or the city better. And frankly, I think are bad examples of bad politicians.
You served in the legislature when Buddy Romer was in office, correct?
No, actually
you came right after him. Right after him. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I ran thinking Buddy Romer was going to be governor. I'll say that. Yeah. I ran in 91.
So you won in the Edwards, Duke, and Romer years.
Right.
But Romer is from your neck of the woods, and most people in 1991 thought he was going to get a second term. It did not happen. And you served with Edwin Edwards in the legislature. But your thoughts about the legacy of Charles E. Buddy Romer III.
Well, you know, I met Buddy when I was in high school. He talked at my high school, and I worked for him as an intern in Shreveport and in Washington, D.C., and I pretty much have known him all my life, and I loved his parents, and his brother-in-law, David Melville, and I worked together in Shreveport when I worked down in at the Lighthouse, and so I feel like I've known the Romers a long time, And I think Buddy was genuinely a kind man and a good man who really wanted to do good. But I don't think he was really a great governor, and he never really could figure out how to work with the legislature. But mm-hmm. I think he had big ideas and stayed in the game a long time trying to make Louisiana better. And so, I just really think that he tried hard for a long time.
Okay, well, let's get down to business for the session. And, Melissa, Louisiana, as Sam Carlin writes in The Advocate today, is poised to soon stop accepting $300 a week from the feds to jobless benefits. This would be a month early under a deal passed by lawmakers in the last hours of the session, a move that would make our state the latest to end benefits over concern from business groups that they're causing a worker shortage. Lawmakers approved this measure to boost the state's unemployment benefits by $28 a week starting next year. It would take effect only if Governor John Bel Edwards ends the state's participation in the federal program by July 31st. Now, that program is giving thousands of laid-off workers $300 a week in addition to whatever they get from the state, which currently is a maximum of $247 a week. So businesses are saying, look, we can't hire people because they can make more on the sidelines than they can make working for us. Your thoughts about ending the jobless benefit, the federal jobless benefit, a bit early?
Well, you know, I actually think that the governor was going to, the jobless benefits were going to end on September the 6th anyway. I think the governor feels like he made a good compromise. I actually think raising the benefits for $28 a week is not enough. I don't know anybody who can live on, you know, $1,000 a month. And so, you know, I think our economy really was affected by the pandemic. People needed the extra money. I think people are ready to get back to work. And hopefully this has made employers value their employees. And I'm actually glad that it's been a little bit difficult. And employers have had to raise their starting pay, you know, a little bit. So, you know, I think all in all, it's worked out to the benefit of the people working in Louisiana.
Well, when we go down the tally of wins and losses, it's not even considered a loss because there was hardly an effort to make it happen this time, knowing the result would be a no-go. But once again, no change in the minimum wage in Louisiana. It's $7.25, and some people believe that, look, if workers made more, then they would be less inclined to take jobless benefits. Your thoughts about us remaining, well, geez, we're going to be $4.75 behind Arkansas for minimum wage. Your thoughts, Melissa?
Well, I think we should have raised the minimum wage several years ago. I know the governor has wanted to do that since he got elected. I think it's just a real shame that our legislature doesn't value the people of the state of Louisiana, and we're willing to keep people living in poverty, working full time. I think we should have passed the minimum wage a couple of years ago, and we should be at about $10 by now. So, you know, I just feel like Louisiana legislators need to focus on the impact of wages on families. And one of the good benefits of the pandemic, I guess, and of the unemployment benefits is that employers have had to come up with $9 or $10 an hour to get people back in the workforce.
All right, Jeff Satto, your thoughts about whether we should raise the minimum wage in the state and the governor's apparent compromise to end the $300 federal jobless benefit on July 31st.
All right, well, I'll go in reverse order here. It was a bad deal. It was going to expire on September the 6th in any event. So, you know, 5 weeks at the, you know, obviously much higher dollar total. But the thing is that this raise now will continue forever, and it will be with state money. It was federal dollars that was paying for the $300 supplement. This will now come out of state pockets, and there was just really no real need to do that. Just if the governor is going to be so obstinate as to continue killing jobs, then, you know, let him do it for another 5 weeks and not put this burden on the on employers and taxpayers for, you know, who knows how long. Minimum wage, some of the same ideas apply there. You know, we look at the data, it kills jobs. It's a canard that, you know, you have all these single people or even singles with dependents living off of it, hardly any earning the minimum wage. The fact of the matter is we need to price labor at where its value is in the marketplace and not set an artificial level to it. You do that, and you just drive up costs in other ways, and just many
Jeff,
negatives to that. So, no, we should not raise a minimum wage at all.
Do you think there should be a minimum wage at all?
No. Ideally, no, there shouldn't be. But it's federal law. It's not going to change, so no reason to raise it above the federal minimum.
All right. Lauren Scott, by the way, shares Jeff's belief that we should have no minimum wage, Melissa.
Oh, Lord. I'm speechless, Jim, so let me just say this. I think we have to have a federal minimum wage. I think we need to raise the minimum wage. I think that we've got to really look at how to support employers and business and profitability of businesses.
877-217-5757. Back with Sato and Flournoy after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we are going to cover as much ground as we can with Jeff Sato and Melissa Flournoy, and it was a busy session, and the legislature got involved in many matters, and this often happens when the state has money, because then lawmakers have time on their hands, and they go to town, and this session is a perfect example of that. Senate Bill 221 by State Senator Sharon Hewitt means that Louisiana will apparently be moving to elections using paper ballots, approved 90 minutes before the adjournment last night. The current law requires Louisiana votes in machines. The legislation would now require a paper ballot that would be scanned to count. Now, Jeff Sato, is this a good thing?
It's got its pluses and minuses. Certainly, it will make elections a little more complicated in terms of tabulation and the like. But it's not an entirely undesirable thing. Canada, to this day, still has elections using all paper ballots. So, if they can do it, I guess we can do it.
Melissa, what about paper ballots?
Well, I think about 28 states use paper ballots, and the idea is that you mark your ballot and then you put it into a scanner, and then the scanner tabulates it. I think there was a lot of discussion at the state capitol of people who really believe the 2020 presidential election was fraudulent and stolen, and the Chinese people hacked all the voting machines. I testified on some of these bills at the state capitol this session, And so I think the Secretary of State really did a good job of trying to thread the needle and calm people down. I think this was a compromise. Verified voting with a paper trail is used in a lot of states. And actually, it should save Louisiana about $60 million.
Okay. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Melissa and Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. You missed the sat out.
By the way, it's Dr. Sato and Dr. Flournoy, but keep going, Dan.
All right, Dr. Sato. Was one of the areas where Jindal was, as you say, ahead of his time, much like McConnell, Ted Cruz, Louis Gohmert today, put his own political ambitions ahead of what's good for their constituents.
That's fair. Would Jindal have been a better governor if he had not worried so much about how it would play when he ran for president, Jeff?
In his second term, I think he would get distracted by certain things. So, for example, when he became against Common Core after he was for it, I think that was kind of more playing to a national audience than anything else. And so, I would agree with that assessment that he allowed himself to get distracted, and if he had not, he could have achieved more.
Mitchell and Sherwood. Mitchell, you're on with Dr. Sato and Dr.
Hey.
Flournoy.
Good morning. I just wanted to say about the governor signing that with the unemployment. Is the federal government giving somebody money to help them out? What makes them have the right to take it away? I don't think that's right. And that's always hurting the poor in this state. We last at everything. We always going to end up last. Minimum wage, that can't. How's somebody going to survive off $7.25? Send your sons and daughters out there for the jobs. You figure they could survive.
All right. You can hear the pain in that man's voice, Melissa Flournoy.
Well, I agree. I think that we need to help pay people. I think that folks need to make a living wage. And I think it's a shame that people work 40 hours a week or two jobs and are still living in poverty.
Patrick now from Ennis-Wald Estates. Patrick, you're on with Dr. Sato and Dr. Flournoy. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, everyone. I think, hey, let's just raise the minimum wage to $50 an hour. And, you know, if an employer can't afford it, I like the fact that I talk to a robot when I go order my food, and food is now pre-made. It's not handmade anymore. It doesn't taste as good, but, hey, it saves cost on labor. And, make it $50 an hour.
All right. How about a $50 an hour minimum wage, Melissa?
Well, I think let's not be ridiculous, okay? Part of the challenge we've got to figure out is how to pay people, how to help people have skills. I do think there needs to be a minimum wage. And, yes, the problem right now we're facing is that a lot of jobs are being automated.
All right. David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning, David.
Yeah, I hope if Patrick's doctor tells him to take an aspirin today, he doesn't go home and take the whole bottle. I'd like to ask the doctor, I've never used recreational marijuana, and I really deplore the use of it, and I'd be drug tested. Doctor, would you support legalizing recreational marijuana? And if you're against it, would you be willing to be drug tested for marijuana?
All right, Dr. Sato. Marijuana legalization is not going to go to the governor's desk, at least not this year, but there are other measures which certainly expand the use of marijuana, decriminalizing possession of small amounts. Your thoughts about full-fledged legalization, is that something that should happen in our state?
No. It's kind of happening. When we look at the medical marijuana legislation that went through, essentially, now you can get, over 100 lids a week at the maximum and for any ailment whatsoever. So you find a doc to write that, and you can get it and do whatever you want with it.
All right, do whatever you want. Melissa, do you think we should have legalization of marijuana in Louisiana?
Yes, I actually do. I think decriminalization was a good first step. I think we need to look at legalization of marijuana and taxation.
All right. Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Carol.
Hey, regards to the unemployment benefits, not everybody gets that maximum. And their ex-employers can contest it. You cannot get unemployment and turn down a job. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Carol. 877-217-5757, Craig in Natchitoches. Craig, good morning. You're on with Jeff and Melissa. Hi, Craig.
Yes, to both doctors there. I wanted to ask, do you think the governor is going to sign House Bill 473, the bill to raise the tobacco and vaping age to 21? I think it passed to both houses, but I think it's sitting on his desk. What is your thought on that?
All right. Raising the vaping age to 21. Is that a good idea, Jeff?
I personally do think that is. I'm not an advocate of allowing smoking in public places for a number of reasons, and I think that would discourage that. Now, whether I'm not really sure what the governor is going to do with that, though.
All right. What about raising the vaping age, Melissa?
I think the governor probably will sign it. Frankly, it's like cigarettes. It's, I wish nobody smoked cigarettes. I wish nobody smoked weed, but people are going to do what they're going to do. But I think the governor probably will sign it.
All right. Excuse me. A proposal to expand Louisiana's definition of domestic abuse to include controlling behaviors like coercion and intimidation was shelved yesterday. And this one was one that many thought would pass, including our friend Mark Ballard, House Bill 159, sponsored by Representative Melinda White of Bogalusa. But it was shelved after a fracas on the floor between Melinda White and Alan Seabaugh. And Melinda White, who's a victim of sexual abuse, took offense when Seabaugh told her she didn't understand the ripple effects of her bill. And then Seabaugh was quoted as saying that Melinda White and Representative White does not deny this, said to him, either I'm going to get my gun and finish this, or let me get my gun and we'll finish this. And White, to her credit, said in the heat of the moment she made comments she shouldn't have made, but she said as a survivor of domestic abuse, she was triggered by the notion that she didn't understand the issue at hand. This is serious business. Jeff, Louisiana has, according to Blake Patterson in his story in The Advocate, fifth highest rate of murder from men to women in the nation, twice the national average. Is this bill just common sense, or does it deserve to be shelved as it was?
No, I think that something like that is something that would be good, would be necessary to help stem that particular problem. It's just too bad that it kind of got caught up in a personality conflict.
We'll get Melissa Flournoy's take when we return. We're back after the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. Some more time with former state representative Dr. Melissa Flournoy and LSU political scientist Jeff Saddo. Mark on Florida, I know this gentleman, he is from the left side of the spectrum, but Melissa, he says, what do you think of Melinda White threatening Alan Seabaugh and not having any consequences? She is a victim of domestic abuse. She acknowledged a mistake, but she did threaten him, according to not only Seabaugh, but other witnesses. Should there be consequences of some kind?
No, I don't think so. I think it's towards the end of the session. Tempers run hot and people are mad, and there have been a couple of efforts of fistfights practically in the hallways. I just think we need to chalk this one up to tempers flaring at the end of the session. I think Melinda White's bill was really a compromise that a lot of lawyers and advocacy groups had worked on. I'm sorry it didn't pass, but I can sure understand how basically Seabaugh got in her grill and got under her skin. And so, I think people say things they don't mean. But the thing that worries me, Jim, is that we did pass permitless carry. So now everybody in Louisiana can walk around with a gun in their handbag or their car. I hope the governor vetoes that, because I do think we've got way too many guns running around in Louisiana, and people do lose their temper. So, I'm sorry, Melinda, bill didn't go through, but I don't think there should be any consequence.
All right. Well, Jeff, what about the law, if Governor Edwards signs it, that would allow citizens to carry a weapon concealed? Already, by the way, already we can carry a weapon on our hip if we want to, but this would expand it to any law-abiding citizen who would have basically concealed carry permit as a right of the state. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a good move. There are almost 20 states that currently do that. We look at the data, and there's no difference in terms of violent crime or crime weapons like that being used in crime in those states as compared to those that don't have that leniency in terms of concealed carry. So, right now there's plenty of that going on, permitless concealed carry. It's just criminals that are doing it.
All right, and a listener asked if we had the tape of Melinda White last night expressing remorse and also anger that her bill was shelved. And really, there are two different issues here, whether you want to punish the lawmaker for making a threat, but that should not reflect the merits of her bill. And here is Melinda White.
Members, I come today with a lot of heartache. And I've made the decision not to run HB 159 for the sake of the body. I am disappointed that we have to let down the victims of domestic violence, an issue I'm very passionate about.
All right, Melissa Flournoy, obviously gripped with emotion, Melinda White, and for good reason.
Well, you know, several of my friends who are in the legislature, I think, are just emotionally exhausted. It's been a hard session. It's been a lot of chaos. You know, I think, you know, I'm sorry that her bill was collateral damage and all this. And I just hope everybody gets a little rest and kind of recovers from what I think was a really grueling legislative session.
Paul Annopoulos, you're on with Dr. Flournoy and Dr. Sato.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, doctors. Just a question on the carry law of guns. Does the bill allow the facility that a person would be coming into to be searched and not allow, or does it supersede the facility's rules? Thank you.
All right. Well, like if a business, Melissa, if a business says no guns, can the business preference supersede what now is the law of the state of Louisiana if Governor Edwards signs it? Although the governor, who is a pro-Second Amendment guy, says he will veto this one, so it may not happen. But what are the ramifications of the bill?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I know that the state capitol is a no-weapon zone. You've got school zones. You've got other things. I would like to think that any private business could, you know, have a no-weapon zone. I don't think guns should be in restaurants or other things, but I actually don't know the answer to that.
In bars, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just think, you know, I just think guns add a whole level of chaos to every situation.
All right. Jeff Sato, what about businesses trumping what might become the law of the state of Louisiana? If they don't like guns in their establishment, will they have the right to say no guns?
Well, the law, all it does is remove the requirement that you have to go through the state for a permit. And so everything else about existing law would still apply, which includes, as I recall, the ability for businesses to say, you know, no concealed weapons allowed if they want.
877-217-5757, and some listeners have asked Melissa and Jeff to comment on a national story that is getting huge attention today. The New York Times broke the story as the Justice Department investigated who was behind leaks of classified information early in the Trump administration. It took a highly unusual step. Prosecutors subpoenaed Apple for data from the accounts of at least two Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee, including Adam Schiff, and family members, including one who was a minor. The records were seized in 2017 and 2018, and these lawmakers are just now finding out about it. Melissa, was this an overreach by the Trump administration and the former president, or was this business as usual?
Oh, no. I think this is bad. I think this is a real overreach, and I'm really concerned about what happened in the Trump administration in terms of that level of surveillance of elected officials, and I think the Justice Department needs to act very strongly in understanding what happened. And, yeah, I just think this is really unbelievable in so many ways.
Dr. Sato, is Melissa on the right track, or is she overreacting?
On the right track in the sense that it is business as usual. Certainly, we look at the Obama administration and its fraudulent use of supposed national security concerns to interfere with the Trump campaign, and, you know, so to me,
but
to
me, the Obama administration subpoena any records from lawmakers?
If that happened, we're going to find out. But that might be a new thing. We really don't know what the Obama administration was doing out there on some of these matters, with some of the leeway apparently it had. But the point being that if there's abuse going on, or there was under the Trump administration in this regard, it's merely continuing a pattern that we saw in those agencies during the Obama years.
Now, our two U.S. senators have diverged on their thoughts about the former president. Bill Cassidy voted to impeach him. And John Kennedy is all in. And, of course, Kennedy's apparently running for re-election and has the blessing of the Donald. Who's on the right track, Cassidy or Kennedy?
In terms of their evaluation of Trump's culpability and, like, Capital unrest, if we're talking about that, I think some information that came out last week tended to be much more supportive of Kennedy than Cassidy. Cassidy seems to be of the opinion that, Trump in some way instigated this or incited the riot, but we have now new information showing that it was, confirming, really adding to information that it was really well-planned weeks in advance.
All right, well, but the former president did say, go down there and show them you're not going to take it anymore. And he criticized the vice president, his vice president, who was threatened with death by some of these marauders. Melissa, is Jeff downplaying this?
Yeah, I think Jeff is downplaying it. And I think Cassidy was afraid. He spoke to a group that I'm a part of, and he talked about the January 6th insurrection, and you could hear sort of his real concern and fear at that event. So, I actually think Senator Cassidy's on the right track. I think that he's sort of a man who's got principles and was really affected by the January 6th insurrection at a personal level. And so I think he's sort of come to his senses from my vantage point. And John Kennedy, I think, drank the Kool-Aid and the weed killer and has just doubled down on Donald Trump. And I think it's going to he is not going to be reflected well in the history books of Louisiana. Kennedy is just he doesn't care about Louisiana. He is just a political showman. And it's really sad. I would have expected better from him.
All right. Well, Bill Cassidy is a doctor, though, and he voted with Trump many, many times. He voted for the Trump budget, which was obviously one that caused huge debts and deficits. And John Kennedy did not vote for that. And, of course, Bill Cassidy also voted to undo Obamacare. And he's a doctor. Should he have known better, Melissa Flournoy?
Yeah, I've had issues with both senators for a long time. Frankly, I was surprised when Cassidy wanting to undo Obamacare. I think he's made some different political decisions. And, we'll just have to see if their paths continue to diverge. I think Cassidy is now interested in possibly in a deal on infrastructure in the Senate.
All right. We're going to spend a few more minutes with Drs. Flournoy and Sato, and then he'll hear from filmmaker Scott Sullivan in our final segment after this timeout. This is Jim Engster. Thanks for being with us. Filmmaker Scott Sullivan on deck. We're wrapping it up with Drs. Flournoy and Sato. And Jeff Sato, a few listeners wanted to know about these vetoes, line item vetoes from Governor Edwards. It includes $400,000 appropriated for a utility substation in the hometown of Blake Miguez, the House Republican Majority Leader. Edwards also removed $1 million for roads in Wynn Parish, where Jack McFarland resides. And these kinds of things, they were done by Bobby Jindal. Danny McCormick also got nailed. $75,000 for improvements in plain dealing, Louisiana. Is the line item veto a good thing or is it a bad thing, Jeff Sato?
Well, I think ultimately it's a good thing, but it's going to be used as part of a political process. And what kind of surprises me is that this budget, HB1, was sent in time to potentially override such vetoes, but none of that. There were no override attempts on line item vetoes or HB20 or anything yesterday. So kind of defeated the purpose and gives the governor more leverage than he might otherwise have.
Dr. Flournoy, your thoughts?
Well, I think the line item veto is a good thing. I haven't looked through the whole budget, but I think there's probably more in there that the governor could veto. And I think the big loser in House Bill 1 is funding for early childhood education. I think the thing that surprised me the most in the legislative session is that we only gave teachers an $800 pay raise. We didn't fund early education. And so I think we really left out the kids. And so I'm concerned about what our priorities are moving forward.
Well, we'll have much to talk about, and hopefully we'll have Jeff and Melissa back on. But there were some matters we didn't talk about today that we will be, an income tax swap that goes to the voters. It was okayed by lawmakers. That's a big one. And Harrah's got a big deal. The big casino in New Orleans, they're going to pay the state $39 million and a little over $1 million for the next 30 years. So we'll talk about it. And thanks again to Drs. Jeff Satto and Melissa Flournoy, two astute observers of Louisiana life and politics. And in studio is Scott Sullivan, a young filmmaker who has the same birthday as one Drew Brees, January 15th, 1979, which makes him 42 years old. Now, in football, when you're 42, that usually means it's time to hang it up, which Drew Brees just did. But when you're in the filmmaking business, you're just getting started, Scott.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's got a production out that premiered last weekend, Trigger Girl. Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser was on hand. I was there. And we're going to talk about that. But a question that we didn't get around to for Melissa and Jeff was about the movie-making extension of the tax break. That did not happen. Just stretch it from 2025 to 2028. How is it out there right now for filmmakers in Louisiana? It's a tough business, and sometimes tax incentives help. Was this something that should have happened in your judgment?
Well, I mean, we all know both sides of the argument, but I tend to see it from the people who work in the industry. Those are the people I see every day, and I know what those incentives mean in terms of them getting jobs, and you just hate to see them nervous or worried about when the next production's coming. So I think it's just something we have to figure it out. We have to figure out how to make it work in conjunction with the other needs of the state. It's definitely not a time to be afraid. It's a time to innovate. And I think that's something that we can do if we put our heads together and make it work.
Well, Scott is a 1997 graduate of Baton Rouge High.
That's right.
And he got into filmmaking about 5 years ago. And it's something that usually requires an immense budget. Tax incentives help. But in your case, you just put out what some believe is a quality film. I've seen it. It looks good. And it's actually got a catchy plot and some familiar faces that we'll get to. But you did it on a shoestring budget, didn't you?
That's right. I mean, the whole idea behind the project was to see if we could make a feature film with enormous constraints. So the first and most major constraint was the financial constraint.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we were doing it during COVID times. So that was an animal unto itself. But we had local talent all across the board, and we pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it speaks volumes to the resources that we have right here in Louisiana to do films. And it only speaks to also what we could do if we have the resources to do more.
Well, some of these films today, as we know, have budgets exceeding $100 million. I think in some cases even $200 million films. And you put out a quality film for a modest amount of money. And when I say modest amount of money, we've talked about the great Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Steven Soderbergh's first film.
Yeah.
Well, it was a low-budget film, but it was not a no-budget film. I did have one of those called Schizopolis, but Sex, Lies, and Videotape, I'm looking at it earned $37 million at the box office. It was made for $1.2 million. How much did you invest in your project?
Oh, Jim, it was nowhere near that. I'll tell you that much. And if I gave a true figure, it would probably, I think people would call me to question on it. But with that being said, that's what we're trying to do moving forward, mm-hmm. is with our new venture that we're starting to develop, is we want to put the film business on both ends of filmmaking here in Louisiana, because we're good at making films. Mm-hmm. We can make them all day, and we can make them with shoestring budgets. But great films are bookended by great business. And that's how something like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, even though the budget was low, there was some great business around it that helped it to get the buzz and the popularity that it got.
Sonny Cranch and John Hardy did a great job, and Steven Soderbergh, he was off to the races after Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Absolutely.
Who wrote the script for Trigger Girl?
You're looking at him.
I thought so.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I wrote the script after I... there's a young lady who I've made a lot of films with. Her name is Trisha Pruitt, and she happened to meet Leo Honeycutt at the City Club, and she told him we were doing films, and Leo said, well, I'll give him a half a day's work if he writes something. So like anybody with half a brain, I wrote an entire feature film starring Leo Honeycutt.
Leo Honeycutt.
And so,
a leading man at 66. Go Leo.
And he is very talented, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of other people. He has something. And the young lady, Madeline Reed, who was also in the film, right here from Louisiana, amazing talent.
She is amazing.
Yes, yes.
Leo was good, but she was great.
Hey, I won't tell him you said that.
No, he was good. He was good. Leo's he's an immensely talented fellow, and there aren't many people. You did this primarily in a house, didn't you?
Well, that's another one of the constraints. When you don't have a big budget, you have to minimize your locations. So it was pretty tough to pull off an entire, it's about an 80-minute film in one location with 3 to 4 people. It's hard to keep the audience engaged, but I think we gave it a good shot.
Yeah, and you got 3 primary stars, 2 women and Leo Honeycutt. And then right at the end, another familiar face to many of our listeners shows up. Leo's wife. Not his real wife.
Not his
not
real
Jackie,
wife.
Not Jackie, but...
Not Jackie.
But I thought I recognized that lady.
Yeah, that was Mary. Do you know Mary?
Mary DeRusso,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He's married to Barry Irwin.
Yeah.
Wonder if Barry will be jealous that Leo... took his wife on the big screen.
He seemed to be a little calm and cool at the time.
Yeah. Well, how did you choose your cast?
Well, of course, Leo, once he became interested in the project, that was a no-brainer. Trisha, who I've worked with before, mm-hmm. She is someone who has amazing talent, both in front of and behind the camera. And Madeline Reed, we found her. She was... doing acting classes in New Orleans, talked to her and instantly knew that she was the one. And I think a lot of people will say it was a good pick. That she plays a very complex part, mm-hmm. and she did a very good job doing it.
Yeah, well, 25 years ago, I was in a film kind of like this one called Dangerous Proposition. Brad Sanders was the filmmaker, and it was a cultivated taste, but he had a bigger budget than you. He really made Baton Rouge look good. Some didn't like the script, but he really did a good job with the cinematography. But you show vast potential doing this with essentially no budget. For those who'd like to see Trigger Girl, how do they do it?
Well, what I would do is I would follow Sully Scope Films on Facebook or on Instagram. We have some very exciting news about Trigger Girl that we'll be announcing soon. So if you just follow us on either of those places, we also have a website, sullyscope.com.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll follow that as well, then you'll certainly be in the know.
Well, I think I know where the Sully Scope comes from. It comes from this gentleman, Scott Sullivan. So it's SulliScope.
That's correct,
sir.
You
can find out more about Trigger Girl. What's the next project?
Oh, the next project, we're actually starting tonight on the next project. It's called Gravity. If there's any crime thriller fans out there who may love the old Miami Vice style of storytelling and cinematography, that's what we're trying to pull off tonight.
Well, good luck to you. And as stated, this guy's just getting started. He shows great potential, and let's hope he gets the opportunity to reach that potential. Thank you, Scott Sullivan.
Thank you, Jim.
First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support. Until Monday with Julie Baxter Pair, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.